Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's best arts and cultural stories. I am Netta Ulaby. This week, before Maurice Sendak wrote Where the Wild Things Are, he painted a mural in a kid's bedroom. More than 50 years later, that mural is now being restored and donated to a museum. Singer Ricky Martin discusses life as an out gay man and a dad, and his first album in 6 years. And a Food Network chef on his new collection of soul food favorites. But first,
Apple also shook up the ebook world this week. The company sent a signal that it will require all ebook app developers, including Amazon and Barnes & Noble, to route their sales through the Apple system. NPR's Lynn Neary has that story.
The apps flap began when the New York Times reported that Apple had rejected an ebook app for the iPhone, which had been developed by Sony. Apple objected to the app because it only allowed purchases of ebooks from the Sony store. That news caused a stir because that's exactly the way ebook retailers like Amazon have been doing business. Customers using the Kindle app, for example, are sent to Amazon.com to buy a book. Now, Apple seemed to be saying consumers should not have to go to the web, but could simply use their app to both buy and read an ebook. And Apple would get a 30% cut of ebook sales. Apple issued a statement saying there had been no change in its policy. James McQuithy, a senior analyst at Forrester Research, says technically that's true, but
there went from being no policy to there being a policy, and now the policy is being enforced. And we assume that enforcement will reach back to include Amazon at some point.
In fact, says McQuivy, this has implications for all retailers with an app. McQuivy says Apple has come to a new realization of the money-making potential of its popular devices.
They have a platform on which people are desperate to provide content because it gives them a way to make money. And Apple thinks, well, fair enough, we're going to collect a toll as you cross over our bridge to the consumer.
But Peter Myers, author of The Best iPad Apps Guidebook, says consumers may ultimately benefit from Apple's move.
Because they'll no longer have to go to a website, to Amazon.com, for example, and they'll be able to buy books directly within the app. And at the end of the day, that means that you buy your books within the app and you read your books within the app. So ultimately, I think the whole reading and shopping experience is going to be better for consumers.
There is always the possibility that Amazon or Barnes & Noble and other ebook retailers might balk and withdraw their apps. But Myers thinks that's unlikely.
Mainly because Amazon has spent a considerable amount of money and time over the past year advancing this message that you can buy a book from them and then read it anywhere you want. So if they had to pull their app or if they decided to pull their app, you're talking about tens of millions of people who wouldn't be able to read their books.
There are still a lot of unanswered questions about exactly what Apple's policy is and how it will be enforced. And both Myers and McQuivy say that may very well be a deliberate strategy on Apple's part. The company will watch to see how people react and then clarify its policy. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
In a New York City apartment on Central Park West, two children snuggled into their beds each night beneath a mural. In fact, the only mural painted by the beloved author and illustrator Maurice Sendak. It shows a parade of characters, a little white dog followed by a boy with a drum, a boy playing a bugle, a red bird, an inquisitive-looking lion holding an umbrella in his tail, a lady in a red dress leading a bear in a top hat, all parading beneath a russet sun. Sendak painted that mural 50 years ago, and now those two children, both in their 50s, have donated it to the Rosenbach Museum and Library, which holds Sendak's other work. We're going to hear from brother and sister Nina and Larry Chertoff in a moment. Earlier, though, I spoke with Maurice Sendak about painting that mural back in 1961.
50 years ago seems quite incredible to me, one, that I'm still living and can talk about it. And two, it doesn't seem possible that it was that long ago, but, you know, that's what we all say. It was that long ago. There was Nina, a little girl, a darling little girl, and her brother Larry, darling little boy. And it was their room, and I was painting a mural on their wall, the one and only mural I have ever done. Obviously, I've never been asked again.
No, you've done everything. You've done books, you've done opera sets. So it's just somebody neglected to offer you a mural.
That is true. If they'd asked, who knows what I would have said.
Oh, God,
it was just a happy time of my life. It's amazing how I remember the time, and I remember what it felt like, and I remember the kids running in and out of the room, and they grew up to be really nice people, and they were awfully nice kids, and we did have a lot of fun.
But how many days do you think it took you to paint this mural in the kids' room? Don't know.
I don't remember.
It was not a day from the look of it.
No, it was not a day. I had to come back, and also I had never painted a mural before. And I did not know how to paint a mural. I did not know how to prepare the surface. There was nobody from the Renaissance around who could advise me. And I did the best I could.
That's one of the biggest problems with those Renaissance artists. They don't hang around.
They don't hang around. They're very snotty people.
Well, Mr. Sendak, it's a delight to talk with you once again. And the mural from I'm looking at it online, just looks terrific.
Well, thank you. And nice to talk to you, too.
That's author and illustrator Maurice Sendak earlier today. And now to Nina and Larry Chertoff, who grew up with that mural in their bedroom and who join us from our bureau in New York. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And do you both remember the mural being painted?
Oh, definitely. I was about 6. Nina was about 4.
Yeah, we watched him, and I remember playing with the paints and walking on the paper. It was very exciting.
It really was. And, you know, he was very sensitive to the sort of the quality of light in the room. So he would come and do, you know, most of the painting during the day, but he would do some in the evening mm-hmm. as well. So I have very lovely memories of sort of that being a lullaby of Maurice's beautiful gestures as he was painting.
Right.
And as we would go to sleep.
Did it occur to the two of you when you were little kids that your friends might have had pictures hanging on the wall or perhaps wallpaper, but not a mural painted in their bedroom, that this was unusual?
I got to say, we did kind of take it for granted. I never really compared it to anything that my friends had. It was just a very natural thing that happened.
Tell me about actually moving this. That is, it's still actually on the wall, or it was actually on the wall. Did you actually have to take the wall down and move it to Philadelphia?
Well, we didn't actually do that. I spoke with the Rosenbach Museum and Library, and they hired some conservators to very carefully move it and took this, you know, 2-ton piece of wall to Philadelphia. It's really quite amazing.
I'm impressed that the mural survived in such good shape. You know, the proper amount of steam heat in New York can be considerably warmer than many other people might expect, and 2 kids growing up, there could be tennis balls hit against a bedroom wall or a basketball, you know.
Indeed,
these are normal
there
things.
Were. Yeah. Pinky ball, right?
Yeah, it survived very well, and, you know, Maurice came back over the years because I believe it was done with an acrylic type of paint, and, you know, the paint was flecking off in certain spots. You paint your apartment every 8 or 10 years or so. And I remember being a kid and saying to my folks, gee, you know, when we paint the room, paint around the mural. Mm-hmm. Don't try to house paint in between the characters. But that didn't always happen. And we had some really good painters. And some of them, you know,
were less good.
Some of them took the initiative and sort of painted in between. From what I understand, the Rosenbachs have figured out a method of getting rid of the house paint and sort of reducing it back to its original state.
So did you ever reach a point when you were teenagers when this younger child's mural and the lovely lion, when it seemed a little childish to you and perhaps you wanted something a little more?
You know, I did go through that a little bit, but only a little bit because I loved the thing so much.
Nina, did you ever feel that?
Actually, my focus pretty much all along was on the fact that the umbrella had our names on it. The umbrella that the lion is holding with his tail have the name Larry and Nina on it. And
I'm looking at that right now.
On the fact that Larry's name was first. And so the rest was very peripheral to me.
I see.
I'm still thinking about that.
So the
it's true. It's really true.
A half a century, and there are some things that still
never
rankle.
Change.
Never
yeah.
change.
I'm a little defensive about the umbrella. I keep going back to maybe it was alphabetical order, or maybe because I was born first. You know.
Well, I think that when he was playing ball with the pinky ball with his friends, they were actually aiming at the Nina on the umbrella.
Well,
that's what I think.
Throwing the Spalding at the
yes.
the Nina on the wall.
Yes,
we did throw the Spalding, but it was between the characters, really. It was not
yeah,
a Nina.
Yeah.
Well, Larry Chertoff and Nina Chertoff, thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure thing.
Our pleasure.
The Chertoffs, brother and sister, grew up with the only mural Maurice Sendak ever painted in their bedroom. They have donated it to the Rosenbach Museum and Library in Philadelphia in memory of their parents, Rosalind and Lionel Chertoff. And you can see photos of the mural, including a close-up of that umbrella, at npr.org.
Now we're going to spend some time with Chef Jeff. You might be familiar with the name from his Food Network show, The Chef Jeff Project. Jeff Henderson is also a best-selling author and a motivational speaker. The award-winning chef first learned to cook while doing time in prison. His latest book is called America I Am, Pass It Down Cookbook, but it's as much a history book as a collection of recipes. The food and the family stories featured in the book explain how the history of African Americans, from slave traditions to Sunday suppers, influenced the way America eats today.
West African slaves brought okra seeds and watermelon seeds, you know, in their dreadlocks. And when they came here to America, they played a big role in farming and cultivation of vegetables here.
Though his name is on the cover, Chef Jeff said he wanted the cookbook to feel like something a community pulled together.
This is a book for the people, by the people. It's a community cookbook. And it was interesting how we found these folks. You know, we did a call through social media, and we asked people to turn in recipes that have been passed down from generation to generation. And this is how we came up with over 130 soul food recipes. Now, a lot...
You know, because not everybody gives up their recipes.
That's
you
true.
Know, that's not easy to actually, you know, put a call out for recipes.
And, you know, that's a challenge we had in the African-American community, because I remember asking my grandfather before he passed away for the recipe for his gumbo. And he was like, boy, I don't have no recipe, better get in this kitchen and watch how I do it. You know, and we just don't document. And it's so important for us to start documenting history so we can tell our own story about, you know, many contributions that we make.
You know, I'd love to put together a meal, if we can, from the cookbook. I have a little idea, so just, you know, follow me on this.
Okay.
I'd love to serve up a recipe and the story behind the recipe, and I'm going to let you choose. Which one should we choose from the cookbook? We both have a copy right here in front of us.
I want to go to the gumbo. And gumbo was a big, big part of bringing the Henderson family together. We were coming up. So that's why I choose the gumbo, you know, with rice and sausages, okra, crab, shrimp, and chicken as well.
Now, I asked you to serve up a story as well as mm-hmm. the dish. What's the story behind the gumbo in this book? And even the word gumbo is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, gumbo is I call it the Southern bouillabaisse. And it's amazing. I love to cook it. There's many great stories behind it as well. My grandfather was the main cook in our family, and he was the one who always cooked the gumbo for the family.
Are we serving biscuits with this meal?
Absolutely. Sweet potato biscuits.
Sweet potato biscuits.
Sweet potato
okay.
biscuits,
all
yes.
right. Put a little something-something in
mm-hmm.
it. And do you use butter or lard in your biscuit?
Well, you know, there's two ways you can go about that. Butter is all about the flavor mm-hmm. with the butter. Lard, you get a more flakier biscuit. I personally prefer butter in my biscuits.
Mm-hmm.
And with this particular biscuit here, you know, you can also take leftover candy yams, mashed sweet potato, and add to the biscuit. Because, you know, back in the day, you know, we didn't waste anything. You know, everything was used. The pot liquor left over from the collard greens, turn that into a soup, use it as a cooking liquid to boil vegetables or whatnot.
Now, we promised that these recipes would come with a story. And this one comes from a very interesting story. It's from Tuskegee, Alabama. And it appeared in How the Farmer Can Save His Sweet Potatoes and Ways of Preparing Them for the Table. And that was a book written by George Washington Carver, someone that we learn about every February
yes.
in Black History Month, someone who contributed much to American agriculture.
Yes, and it would be amazing to find out that he cooked and had
what didn't he do?
As well. He done everything.
He
was an
everything.
Innovator, a renaissance man, wasn't he? Yes.
He did a little bit of everything. Now, for dessert, we've been waiting patiently to get to dessert because the studio smells so good
now. Well, you know, I brought some desserts here to NPR studio here today for you, Michelle.
And I've been trying. if I've been talking a little bit fast in the course of this interview, it's okay. Because I've been eager to get to dessert because it looks so delicious.
Yes.
What did you bring in for us?
Well, we have a southern pecan pie, and we have a buttermilk pound cake.
Oh, but you're not done because over behind me, and pardon me.
Yeah,
if
well,
reach
you know,
for
I was
going to
save the best for last.
We have a big old basket
yes.
here. What's in this?
We have some red velvet cupcakes.
Mm. Mm.
Yes, with cream cheese whipped on the top there. Amazing, great, moist, wonderful flavor. You going to have a bite with me?
I am going to have a bite with you. Now, the red velvet cupcake has had a renaissance. You can find them. Sorry if I'm talking and chewing at the same time. But you can find them all over the place. This was really a southern treat for many, many years.
Yes. And
people didn't always use food dye.
They didn't. They used to use red beets and vinegar. I don't use vinegar in mine. I just don't like the vinegar taste.
Mm-hmm.
I actually use food coloring versus the beets because we wanted to make this Pass It Down cookbook recipes very simple for the home cook. So we didn't make it too complex. But there's many people make it many, many different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
What do you want people to do with this cookbook?
I want people to understand the stories and the connection that African Americans played in history in this country and food. I want people to document and save the recipes that came from their family from generation to generation.
And you have a place for them to do that.
Absolutely,
in the back of the
right
cookbook.
In the back of the book. And that was one of the most amazing additives to this book. Is this book stays in the kitchen. It should never leave the kitchen. It should be in the kitchen for hundreds of years because whoever comes along and opens this book, there's recipes in the back, and they can document themselves.
Chef Jeff, always good to talk to you.
Likewise.
That was Chef Jeff Henderson. His latest book is called America I Am, Pass It Down Cookbook, over 130 soul-filled recipes. And you can find a few of those soul-filled recipes at npr.org.
One of the finest classical actors of his generation, Brian Bedford, has donned all manner of period costumes. But these days he's wearing lady stockings, along with Victorian dresses and outrageous hats, as the imperious Lady Bracknell in Oscar Wilde's comedy of manners, The Importance of Being Earnest. Mr. Bedford is directing the Broadway production as well, and reporter Jeff London spent some time with him as he prepared to take the stage.
About an hour and a half before the Wednesday matinee, Brian Bedford arrives at the American Airlines Theater to become Lady Bracknell. He quickly slips out of his casual street clothes, sweater, sweatpants, and into a tie-dyed T-shirt and robe.
The transformation begins.
So what's the first thing that you do after you get into your tie-dyed T-shirt?
The first thing is what's happening right now. Nellie prepares my hair for the wig. I get into a wig cap because a wig cap goes underneath the wig.
And for the next hour or so, bit by bit, the distinguished 75-year-old actor turns into one of dramatic literature's iciest and funniest characters. Bedford's makeup is all laid out on the dressing table, and he painstakingly applies it himself.
Up until about a week ago, a very good makeup man did this, and then he tutored me and taught me how to do it. Now I do it myself, and I kind of like it. It's sort of a relaxing kind of preparation, you know. It's also like doing a painting, except it's on your face. It's kind of fun, you'll see.
And while Bedford paints his face, he talks about how he came to direct and star in this production, which was first done at the Stratford Shakespeare Festival in Canada 2 years ago. It was artistic director Des McAnuff's idea to have Bedford do double duty with Oscar Wilde's farce.
I read it about two or three times, you know, before I gave McAnuff the decision. And I saw during the first reading that Lady Bracknell was a wonderful part.
To lose one parent, Mr. Worthing, may be regarded as a misfortune. To lose both looks like carelessness.
I know it's a satirical farce. Oscar is sending up society people of 1895, and in rather a subversive way. But although he saw them as being extremely stupid people and funny people, of course they weren't that to themselves. And so I thought that was the way into it.
Mr. Worthing, I confess I feel somewhat bewildered by what you have just told me. to be born, or at any rate bred, in a handbag, whether it had handles or not. Seems to me to display a contempt for the ordinary decencies of family life that reminds one of the worst excesses of the French Revolution.
Once Bedford finishes applying his makeup, he goes through two pre-show rituals. First, one of the actors gives him a neck and back rub. Then Sarah Topham, who plays Gwendolyn, Lady Bracknell's daughter, comes in to put on his false eyelashes.
For some reason, Brian has decided that he trusts me.
On and off stage.
On and off stage.
We've worked together an awful lot.
A lot. Well, this is what I always say to people, that Brian Bedford has played my fiancé, my father, and my mother.
In Wilde's Comedy of Errors, two young women, Cecily and Gwendolyn, think, to their bewilderment, that they've fallen in love with the same man, named Ernest.
It is certainly very curious, for he asked me to be his wife yesterday afternoon at 5:30. If you would care to verify the incident, pray do so. I never travel without my diary. One should always have something sensational to read in the train.
After Sarah Topham leaves, hair and wig supervisor Nellie Laporte returns and carefully places a large wig of gray curls on Bedford's head.
So, you know, they say that clothes make the man. And I'm assuming that...
Now, you know, do you know something? They really do make this woman. Well, you can see the frocks there. When you get into those things and you get all this stuff on and you get the wig on, you are more than halfway there.
Bedford says he's developed his Lady Bracknell from watching and knowing some of the grand dames of the stage, Maggie Smith and Irene Wirth among them. And as he steps into his long skirt, high-collared lace blouse, and beaded jacket, he could well be their big-boned sister. Still, there's one more element to the costume.
The hat is the cherry on top of the sundae, and that completes the transformation.
Well, not entirely. Bedford says he spends the 20 minutes before his first act entrance going through all his lines, getting the voice just so.
Good afternoon, dear Algernon. I hope you are behaving very well. That's not quite the same thing. In fact, the two things rarely go together. Good afternoon, Mr. Worthing.
The importance of being Ernest with Brian Bedford as Lady Bracknell will be on Broadway through July 3rd. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
And to see a slideshow of Brian Bedford becoming Lady Bracknell, you can go to our website, npr.org.
When Ricky Martin released his last pop album in 2005, his familiar image was a sexy, heterosexual Latin pop singer. Since then, Ricky Martin has come out as gay, and he's just released a new album and is heading out on tour, NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin reports.
If you were to open up a time capsule from 1999, this track would be in it. Twelve years ago, Ricky Martin was catapulted into global fame with his Ken doll looks and cheerful pop tracks. But he was actually a big shot singer long before Livin' La Vida Loca. That's Martin performing as part of Puerto Rican boy band Menudo. He joined in 1984 at the age of 12 and was a member for 5 years. The group was hugely popular during that time. At one concert in a Brazil stadium, 130,000 fans showed up, double the capacity.
It was all about discipline.
That's Ricky Martin.
I was part of a band, and I was supposed to sing this song, and I was supposed to say whatever they told me to say, and to wear the clothes that they told me to wear, and dance the choreography that they told me to dance. Now it's about entertaining. Now it's freedom. Now it's about not wearing masks and just being who I am.
I'm as happy as I can be, 'cause I'm allergic to tragedy.
On his new album, Musica Alma Sexo, or Music Soul Sex, many tracks have both English and Spanish versions.
I know maybe the snow, it's just gonna
You cannot translate the songs. You just, when you write an English song, you write an English song. And then when you start writing in Spanish, you just have to start from zero. If you're lucky enough to find the same, you know, storyline, well, you're lucky. There's one song that is called Shine, and in Spanish it's called Te Vas. The Spanish version is You're Leaving, and the English version is Everything About Love.
Another track is a closer match. In English, it's called Liar, and in Spanish, No Te Miento. Por lo menos no te miento.
Te digo la verdad. It's a conversation with the audience where I say, you know, I'm explaining to you where I've been, and I'm going to be really honest. I never lie to you.
Martin dodged rumors about his sexuality for years until last March, when he wrote on his website that he was a proud and fortunate homosexual man. Many wondered how audiences, especially in Latin America, would react to his coming out. Martin says the response has been very positive.
If I knew it was going to be so amazing, it was going to feel so right, and if I knew the reaction of the audience and the media was going to be so positive, I would have done it a long time ago.
You can hear the theme of being out in the new album, like in this song called Será, Será. Escondiéndote en las sombras, no vas a encontrar. Martin sings, hiding in the shadows, you won't find what you're looking for. Never. When he tours this spring, he's bringing his 2-year-old twin sons, Mateo and Valentino, with him.
They have their passports ready, the buses are ready, the hotel rooms are ready, and I can't wait to go back on the road.
Ricky Martin's new album, Música Alma Sexo, came out this week. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to NPR's Arts Channel at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulaby. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.